Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On February 5th, 2007, Charity Lee Bennett was working her shift at Buffalo Wild Wings in Abilene, Texas, when two police officers came to inform her that her four-year-old daughter Ella was dead and her 13-year-old son Paris had killed her. He had convinced the babysitter she should go home and afterwards entered the room of his sister. She was beaten and strangled and stabbed 17 times. On March 20th, 2018, FilmRise released the chilling documentary, The Film, The Family I Had, which recounts the tragic and unimaginable story of Charity Lee Bennett and how a family struggles to move forward. Part true crime, part mystery, Charity Lee, mother of both the victim and killer, relives her agony and her journey of love 10 years later in this feature documentary that also presents multiple and conflicting accounts, leaving the audience questioning where the ultimate truth and accountability lie. The documentary we're featuring this evening is The Family I Had, an engrossing look at an unthinkable crime, with my special guest, producer, director, and filmmaker, Katie Green. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Katie Green.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you very much. Very powerful documentary. Let's get to... You co-produced this and directed this with a partner. Tell us about your partner and tell us about the genesis of this. How long ago did you plan, you and your partner, to do this? Tell us a little bit about the beginnings of The Family I Had.
Sure. I'm one half of a co-directing team, the other half, Carly Rubin. And I have been working together for almost, I think, 10 years now. So we first directed together on our first documentary called The Dead Mothers Club, which looked at women who'd lost their mothers when they were young and looking at following them through various crossroads of their life and looking at how they were dealing with that. And it was towards the end of that, I think the film was complete when we became very interested in juvenile justice. And I think at the time there was a lot of stuff going on in the Supreme Court with the end of juvenile life without parole. And there was lots of stuff that was very interesting in grabbing our attention. And we actually, through another brother company of ours that was doing another documentary on death penalty, came across Charity Lee. She'd written a blog on juvenile justice, and you know, we really loved the way that she wrote and really fascinated by her. And then as we learned more about the Ella Foundation, we found out her personal story. So we immediately called her up and said, look, we're interested in this, you know, I understand you have a son in prison, and you know, she just was really open to talking to us straight away. And yeah, so it was, we always say, for us, it was an interesting transition from looking at women who'd lost their mothers to actually, you know, looking at a mother who'd lost her children. And it was kind of the reversal of grief. And we've always been very fascinated in families and family stories and how families overcome, you know, trauma and tragedy and dysfunction. And we were just immediately really drawn to Charity, who at the time was, I think, in the early months of pregnancy with her son, Phoenix. And so we thought, this is a really interesting time. She's in this interesting transitional stage as well. So we began filming with her, I think it was 2013, I think 2013. And yeah, we only just finished up, obviously, last year. So it was a good few years in the making. And yeah, as we at first met Charity and spoke to her, and then as, you know, we were speaking to her, we realized that there were so many other parts of the story we were originally looking at trying to make her story one of several stories as a look at the sort of juvenile justice system as a whole. But as the sort of layers started to come away and we understood the depth of what was going on in this family, we thought, actually, this is a whole separate, unique story that is kind of worthy of its own platform. And that's when we started to speak to Paris and eventually to Kyla as well. So the story sort of came together that way.
In the introduction, I talk about the Paris stabbing his sister 17 times and beating and strangling her. And you talk about your initial intent with this was to examine the juvenile justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Going into this, how much did you look at this in terms of his story and what the police had said? Again, his culpability, his guilt in this. How far did you look? I mean, what did you look at in terms of that story, and how confident were you that you could still have this aim to your documentary once you realized the factual information of this case?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously we came into it looking at, you know, examining juveniles who were serving incredibly long sentences. And Paris obviously stood out. It's a very unique type of story and a unique type of case. And our feeling was always that, you know, we always felt that there was some reform needed in the juvenile justice arena. And we, you know, of course, we appreciated that Paris was going to be more of a challenge for an audience to kind of get around, because you're trying to sort of make a plea for something that, you know, people, it's a very complicated story and a very complicated case. But I think for that reason, we were like, no, this is why a story like this should be examined with, you know, with the through the prism of juvenile justice, you know, because every child, we believe, deserves the opportunity for the, you know, the best possible care, even if they do something wrong, even if they do something bad. And that's the challenge of, you know, society. And so that's, for us, like, we appreciated it was a more complicated angle, but we really felt that it wasn't something we wanted to shy away from, because it wasn't going to be easy and it was going to be hard for people to swallow. That was the reason why we thought, no, for those reasons, that's why we need to really be, you know, giving this a platform and opening it up and having a dialogue about this and talking about how this does fit into a conversation about juvenile justice reform, what we do feel justice looks like in this kind of story, and also brings in lots of other really interesting sides of, you know, what it's like for a family when you have a loved one, a child who's incarcerated, but a parent who's trying to co-parent with a system, with an institution like a prison, and the complications of that. And of course, mental health as well is also a huge factor in the incarcerated population, you know, whether or not those needs are addressed and whether or not the justice system is really equipped to handle that is also another question I wanted to bring up. So again, I mean, as we sort of were talking about before, I think this was a film that offered us an opportunity to ask a lot more questions than necessarily give answers. But that was what drew us to this story.
Before we explain some of this story, let's introduce the characters that you had to work with and did an incredible job of just using those few characters. So please introduce the characters that you did interview for this and make up the bulk of this documentary.
Sure. I mean, yes, that was a challenge. You know, we really center on specifically one character, Charity, who's the mother whose 13-year-old son murdered his 4-year-old sister. And Charity was the first person that we started speaking to, and she's the kind of the one who we feel in the film is the person you're kind of following and kind of rooting for a little bit. Her son, Paris, who is now, I think he's 23 now, is in prison in Texas, and we have limited access to him, obviously due to his situation. But he does appear in the film on occasion, but he's, you know, he very much is a a character who I think people have been used to. He takes up a lot of space, even if he's not in it that much, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And then Kyla, who is Charity's mother, Paris's grandmother, who Charity and her mother were estranged when we first met Charity. And as we sort of learn in the film, there's a whole other sort of backstory going on with her and her and Charity's relationship. So it's really, really only have three characters. I mean, we do meet Cayman, who is Charity's stepsister, Kyla's youngest daughter. And we do meet, obviously, Phoenix, who is Charity's little boy. As I said, she was pregnant when we first met her and started filming with her. And so we
right.
follow, you know, the first few years of his life. Yes, and a couple of Charity's friends who are in and out. But really, the film centers on those three characters, you know, these this kind of three generations of this one family, the son, the mother, and the grandmother.
You talked about the, and you do feature in this documentary very, very interestingly, the fascinating character of the mother, Kyla. But you also alluded to the background, the very, very interesting background, and then the questions that arise from that in terms of, is there a genetic predisposition? So tell us a little bit about some of the facts surrounding her mother that's very interesting, at least, to consider and factor into this story.
Sure. Well, I don't know how much I want to give away, but what we learn about Charity's mother, and as I say at the beginning of the film, you know, they were estranged and their relationship was very complicated. And we learn that Charity's father, Kyla's husband, had also died mysteriously when Charity was a little girl. And Kyla, her mother, was tried but acquitted for his murder. So there is this other kind of, you know, interesting twist that was very unexpected. And we knew about this kind of early on, and we weren't sure how much we were going to try and bring into this, but we sort of felt that it was necessary to give the, you know, a bit of background context. That is a sort of something that hangs over, I suppose, in the background. We don't go into that murder, and we don't... as I said, we don't provide any further answers or investigation into that, but it was something that we felt was, you know, an important part of the context of understanding the family and also the tensions between the mother and daughter.
You also talk about, and you also, pardon me, you feature so many amazing home movie footage of Ella.
Yeah.
And interacting also with Paris, and very affectionately interacting as they're much younger and she's a newborn, or, you know, very, very young. And then you also have all of this home footage. It's very, very powerful considering that Ella's dead and the situation with Paris obviously being her killer. How important was it, because I think this documentary has a different look, to use more of that footage and, again, make less big and distinctive statements with the footage itself that you consider for this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, with this story, you know, yeah, there is this one big character who we're all aware of, but we never get to meet, and that is Ella. And we, yeah, that's one of the things about working with a family is, of course, you do have access to this amazing archive, and Charity is always incredibly open and generous with all the family archives. And it gave us an opportunity to, I think for this, it was such a shocking story, and it's so sort of unrelatable. I think when people first hear it, they think, God, you know, I can't even imagine. And of course, you know, no one would want to. Why would you want to be able to imagine that? But I think it was important for us to be able to use this archive to say, yeah, this is a really extraordinary, incredible, and complicated, shocking story, but ultimately this is a family, and they do normal family things, and I think there's something really relatable about the archive. You know, just it sort of, I think it was important for us to be able to make a connection for the audience with this family and show that, you know, before this tragedy and trauma, you know, this was just a sort of normal family in so many ways, as much as any family is normal. So yeah, it was one way of kind of doing that. And also I think because Paris is someone who we have limited access to, and obviously is someone who, you know, I think of course people come to him with their ideas, their preconceptions of who he is and what he's like. And it was important for us to try and show that, you know, he was someone before this as well. And again, like try and make him in some way a sort of relatable character as well, because I think we wanted to show the truth of everybody. And I think to try and show the truth, you have to sort of have an understanding of someone before, during, and after. And that was our way of trying to do that.
In this documentary, you could have had Charity Lee have a completely different response to the killer of her daughter, that being her son. And again, there are things that she says later about this very, very complex emotional response to her son that's incarcerated. So you do show footage of them visiting, and again, this trying to keep her family together and move forward with her family. And that's very, very fascinating. So, but what is her opinion? What is her feeling about her son and considering the murder of her daughter? Those are complex feelings, but what is her sense of feelings towards her son now that he's locked up?
Well, I mean, firstly, I mean, I don't feel like a, you know, I can't answer that. Any charity can answer that. But, you know, during the process of filming her, of course, that was something that we felt all the time. You know, we're conscious of she's constantly battling with, you know, this is her child and she loves him, and she, you know, her mother has unconditional love for her children, and you know, as a mother, she's no different. And so she struggles with that, but she also, you know, obviously is horrified by what he did and wants him to be helped. And I think that's a hard, it's a very hard question for me to answer, obviously, as not being Charity, but I think that was kind of at the heart of why we found this story so fascinating, and what we try to sort of show throughout the film is that she's constantly battling with that. And I think there are times when, you know, we would be speaking to her about Paris, and you could tell that she had, you know, this love that she, you know, she would miss him, and she'd be wanting to miss, she hadn't seen him in a while, and she'd want to see him, and she'd, you know, still her baby. And then she'd have times when she's really angry with him, and then she'd have times when she really needed distance from him. And I think she feels all those things, and I think that's why this was a really interesting story for us to follow, because I think it showed all the wide spectrum of human emotions and the sort of nuanced feelings that someone would have in that situation. It's not black and white, it's a big gray area. And yeah, that's the truth, I think, of where things are for her. It's somewhere along that at any given time, and it changes all the time.
What did Charity want and her mother, Kyla, want in terms of a result in terms of court? You said that the defense lawyer pled him not guilty, but what did they want for him? Where did they want to see him go and be dealt with? How?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I mean, I really, that was also a line that for me was really powerful when we were looking at the juvenile justice issue, because I think Charity says this great line about the defense attorney just wanted him to be not guilty. Prosecution just wants him to be guilty. And you know, I think she says someone should be giving a damn about what happened to this kid. And obviously, as the parent, she cares, but she felt there should be another kind of, also as a victim, it was difficult for her to, you know, take on that role as well. I mean, I think they would have liked for there to be more more mental health support, more intervention to try and figure out what exactly had gone on and how best to help Paris. Whilst also recognizing that he needed to be kept away from charity and obviously punished for what he did to Ella. So that's sort of a much bigger question that I guess for them they have one answer, but what should society do with a case like this? What is the right thing to do? And I think there has to be a more holistic approach to it, not just kind of looking at, okay, you're either innocent or you're guilty, and if you're guilty then you get this, and if you're innocent then you get this. And in reality, we're all complicated, and there's, especially with kids, there's this huge gray area in the middle of how much can we help, what kind of help, and for how long. So I think they would have liked more mental health intervention.
The idea, too, that she was looking for answers, Charity was looking for answers, and then she was given a diagnosis. And so, and very, very interesting part of this documentary is the statement she says about when she reaches out to the profilers and the FBI, the famous Park Dietz, the doctor. But what is the diagnosis, and then what does Charity feel about that diagnosis? And as filmmaker, what does that have to do in your mind with mental illness, or the issue, or the controversy, or the question of mental illness in this documentary?
Are you referring to the, I think it was one of the Park Dietz doctors that she describes had told her that she should sort of run and hide. I think that, what a shocking and terrifying diagnosis to get, obviously, about your child.
Sure.
But also, what an unrealistic response. Very few mothers would just run and hide from their children. So I think, in a way, maybe it's also opening up some sort of flaws within that system of how we diagnose someone. If someone gets this diagnosis, do we just put them over here and say, God, I gotta get away from, as far away from you as possible? Or is there a way to actually work with people to try and create some sort of better understanding, and also hopefully improve on those complicated relationships with family as well. We're not doctors, and I wouldn't claim to be able to say what should happen or what could have happened or anything like that. I think if anything, it maybe just opens up more questions about complicated mental health issues, personality disorders, and the kind of taboo of that, and being able to talk about it more and have a better understanding and figure out more realistic ways and healthier ways for us to deal with people who do suffer from these issues.
Well, why I mention this is because the diagnosis that she got through the psychopathy checklist was that he was a sociopath or a psychopath. Sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, it's with Park Dietz saying, you better go take your money and run, it seemed to say pretty clearly that there is no cure for a psychopath. But then we have the issue of, you say, mental illness, but also how responsible is someone at 13 years of age when they're considered by many countries and judicial systems as a child?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is one of the very, very sort of interesting and, ultimately the kind of fundamental question that we're asking. No matter what kind of evidence or no matter what you could stack on Harris to sort of, of course, he is responsible. Can he be held fully accountable? Can any child at 13 be held fully accountable? Even if he is, I don't want to put labels on him, but even if he does suffer from mental health problems, that's not his fault either. So how it, it's It's a very big, complicated question. I wouldn't be able to answer that, I'm afraid. I think it's very... I think the label thing is something that in a way kind of makes people feel like, okay, so they're that, and we can, you know, that's something that's horrible and we don't understand it, and we can just put it over there. And I don't know if it brings us any closer to really making us feel any better about it either, because give a 13-year-old 40 years and, you know, without help, and what good does that do either?
You talk about the unconditional love that Charity Lee has decided to, you know, to deal with her son with this unconditional love, rather than any other way of dealing with this. But she is still conflicted. You talk about the new addition to her family, this Phoenix, and then again her conflicted emotions regarding visiting her son. She had received this diagnosis, so that she is, again, conflicted with her thoughts about the safety of her child. And we talk about what she does in terms of something cathartic for her, and you feature this as well, that the advocacy that she is doing to try to deal with this issue in her life.
The Ella Foundation.
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I think Charity is someone who really wanted to try and see some good come from this awful tragedy. And she set up the Ella Foundation, which is a nonprofit that supports families that are going through similar situations, and provides advocacy and really tries to mediate between victims and offenders, which is obviously the position that Charity has. And I mean, I think she's very honest about the fact that as both the sort of victim and the person who unconditionally loves the perpetrator of this crime, you know, she is conflicted and she goes back and forth, and she's she has times when she has a lot of compassion, I think, in some ways, for Paris, but, you know, people in prison in general. And she's really got into, I think she became very political through this. I mean, she did a lot of like anti-death penalty stuff, and I think she's a really wonderful advocate for justice reform. But at the same time, of course, you know, does understand the complexity of also being a victim and being afraid. And I think in that way, she's a really amazing person to be talking on these issues, because she sort of understands both. As a human being, she seems to have compassion, but as, you know, a mother, she's also she knows what it's like to lose someone.
You worked with her extensively. Obviously, she's featured in this. It's remarkable, her candidness, because as you talk about in this documentary, that in the place that they were in Abilene, Texas, a very religious place, you say, with far more churches than anywhere else, that the people weren't so shy giving their opinions, were they, after this, in that community?
I mean, that's something that I think we can all relate to. You know, if you're in a small town and something terrible happens to you, how many people are able to offer love and support and compassion, and, you know, how many people judge. And, yes, of course, that's something that she went through. And she's incredibly honest. And I think she sort of goes through her life, I think, wearing her heart on her sleeve. I mean, even, you know, her tattoos, which are all very visible, which are all a story of, you know, tell another story in itself. I think she always says that she believes that secrets make you sick. And through telling your story, and through sort of the sort of therapy of telling your story, can heal you. And I think she really believes that. And I think we really owe her her candidness and her honesty and her openness. I think she really believes that there is a greater understanding to be to be gotten through telling her story and letting people hear her story and relate to it or not relate to it. You know, maybe some people hear it and they can't relate to it at all. Many of us, you know, of course can't. So I think it was really great that she had that opinion. I mean, for us, it was as filmmakers to be working with someone who wants to get their story out there and has their own kind of belief about it being healing. That was really, really powerful.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity, Katie, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is eHarmony. I'm married, so I can't tell you about my personal experience with eHarmony, but our good friend Rachel just signed up at our urging. And when she visited the eHarmony website, she was definitely interested. She created a profile, chose some really good photos of herself, but she started with the relationship questionnaire, which she thought it seemed like a little bit of work, but she could easily see its importance in helping her find the kind of person she was really looking for and really is looking for. It's only been a few weeks, but she's enjoying communicating with those few gentlemen that responded to her profile. And she said it was easy and it's well worth the effort. So eHarmony takes steps that other dating sites don't in order to find you a more compatible match. eHarmony is built to help you find lasting, meaningful relationships, not a shallow hookup site. Right now, my listeners can get a free month with eHarmony when they sign up for a 3-month subscription. Enter my code MURDER at checkout. Stop waiting and start your journey to a satisfying relationship. It can be fun to play around with online dating apps, but when you're ready to fall in love with someone and have a meaningful relationship, there's one app that's built to bring you real love, eHarmony. Come see how eHarmony can change your life. Go to eHarmony.com and get started. Enter my code MURDER at checkout. That's eHarmony.com. Enter my code MURDER at checkout. You talked about the incredible cooperation that Charity Lee exhibited in this documentary for your ability to be able to make this powerful documentary, but also that she felt it was important for this story to be told. And just like her advocacy work, cathartic and something that she needs to do to help other people to see some purpose of, not a purpose, but some meaning to Ella's death. How long is this documentary span in terms of time? From the time you, how long does it cover in terms of time?
Sure. As we said, we met Charity when she was, I think, about 5 or 6 months pregnant with Phoenix. So that's always a useful, you can always kind of tell from that. But so we started filming in 2013 and we finished filming in beginning of 2017. And so, yeah, that's 4 years. And obviously we were filming, you know, on and off, sometimes more than others, and they go through various moves and changes throughout that time. But yeah, 4 years, which seems to be on average how long we tend to spend on a feature documentary.
Right. We talked about, we really didn't talk about his sentence, but he received a sentence where he is eligible for parole at the age of 33 years of age, so 20 years before his first parole eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
You also talked about his incredible IQ of 141, so
yeah.
He was always very, very bright guy. You do offer, again, not so conclusionary things in this documentary, so it's up to the viewer to sort of determine, and again, more questions than answers, it certainly seems. But you talk about, you feature Kyla and you feature Charity too, talking about Paris's, any indication that there was something wrong with Paris before this fatal incident. Yeah, again, you don't there aren't big conclusions, but tell us a little bit about that investigation and what you offer in this documentary.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the first thing that people ask, and still, you know, when we talk about the story, when we say, oh, it's a, you know, this is a film about a mother who's overcoming her 13-year-old son murdering his 4-year-old sister, of course, the first question people ask is, why? Why did he do it? And so, you know, of course, that was the first thing that we asked. And I think it was really important. We have one point in the film when, you know, we actually just got charities sort of, she was just saying, these are the things that people ask me all the time. Because I think it's kind of on everybody's lips straight away, like, you know, why did he do it? And I think it became, you know, pretty clear after our first interview with her that that was not going to be an answer. You know, we weren't going to get a straightforward answer. Of course, if there was a clear answer as to why he did it, or if there had been some very clear indication that he was going to do it, you know, it's just not, you know, the reality of this. And we were interested in what Paris was like before this happens. And you know, you sort of do rack your brain because you think, gosh, you know, how could you not have seen that someone could be capable of this? Because we like to think that would be something that's so awful that it would be really glaringly obvious, you know. You know, of course, and for charity, she didn't have any indication or any clue or idea that he would be capable of this. So we're sort of left, you know, we're following her, who's also asking herself all these questions as well. I think it was important for us to try and show that there had been some investigation into that, to try to understand it, to try and understand why. But again, I think, as we keep saying, this is not a film that was going to be able to offer a nice, clean, okay, put that away and file that under why and move on. I think this is a very nuanced story, and we asked Paris, you know, why, and I don't think he's able to really know yet either. And hopefully that's something he might be able to, at some point in his life, be able to understand better. But, I mean, as he actually says, prison is not really a place that offers you much opportunity to sort of sit around and ask yourself why, because it's actually a place that, for him, certainly the way that he is described to us, was just somewhere that you're trying to survive. And you can't really afford to let yourself become too vulnerable by getting too deep in your thoughts. There was some investigation, but as we learned pretty early, there was no easy answers in this story.
You talk about mental illness and no easy answers, but you also talk about that Charity says that when she was pregnant with Ella, that Paris wasn't happy, and she was concerned. And mm-hmm. you don't, again, it's not a full investigation of that statement, but that is a very dramatic or interesting or powerful statement on its own in terms of reasoning. And you also show that at Charity, lost her father at 5 years old. There's no father in Paris's life, or at least not as a role model or a functioning father figure in his life. Is this lack of attention, is this an important issue? Being the center of attention for his mother's affection, isn't it an issue that's brought up in this documentary?
Firstly, I think I would say, Charity does say that, you know, when she was pregnant, she noticed that Paris wasn't happy about that. But, you know, I think a lot of kids who have that time, have their mothers to themselves, you know, I think he was eight or something by the time Ella was born, you know, you have all that time to yourself, and I think it's pretty normal from what I understand, for, you know, the oldest child to feel a little bit, I guess threatened is a strong word, but, you know, to feel a bit uncomfortable, I guess, when there's a new baby on the way, to sort of feel like, oh, wait,
right.
You know, I'm not the center anymore. That's very normal. And I don't think it would be fair to say, well, you know, that was a sign, because I think that any mother, I think what she actually does go on to say is, you know, as soon as she was born and Paris met her, he fell in love with her and he was a wonderful brother. So, you know, I think, yeah, you can sort of find these little signs along the way. Yeah, he didn't have a sort of strong father figure around. Lots of children don't.
Yeah.
And I don't think I think, yeah, of course, there are these little things. And maybe if you put them all together and you sort of build a case, yeah, of course, they all may play their little roles. But I think, you know, lots of children may feel a bit, you know, neglected when a new baby comes along. Lots of kids grow up without positive father figure or parental figures in their lives, and not all of them would commit a crime like this. So I think it could be a bit dangerous. I think that's kind of why we wanted to steer away from that. We felt like, you know, I'm not really sure if this is, it's relevant to a certain extent to understanding this particular story, but I don't know if it really, you know, says anything either way.
Mm-hmm. You profile and feature the relationship between Charity and her mother, Kyla, and they are not on the same page in terms of very much in this documentary, are they? They don't agree on much.
No, I mean, they have a very complicated relationship. We learn that, you know, even from, I think, Charity's teenage years, they started to, they sort of butt heads a little bit and have a complicated relationship. That and I think, you know, I think their relationship continued to be complicated, though they have they are in a much better place now. I mean, all families have complicated relationships. They're very strong, intelligent, strong-willed women as well. Like sort of matriarchs of their own domains, and I think that could also bring about tension. But no, their relationship, as you learn in the film, is has got, you know, very difficult and complicated at times. But also they also have times when, you know, we were with them where they really got along and they seem to have a very similar sense of humor, you know, incredibly bright. Everyone in this family is incredibly intelligent and sort of a great appreciation for history and literature, and they make these sort of very wonderful, interesting references that, you know, kind of beyond Carly and myself a lot of the time. They also have a, you know, a very strong bond.
Yeah. When Paris speaks about the motivation for this, there's different snippets in this that he talks about the day itself. He talks about his feelings that day. It seems genuine. Doesn't seem rehearsed. It seems honest. And he does say some things later about it seems that this could have been in response to his mother neglecting him, or it's some terms of punishment. What is his official position on responsibility with this? How does he talk about his responsibility in this? And how does he, in general, how does he come across?
Paris, you know, much like his mother, is kind of, you know, he was open, polite, you know, very clear in interviews. He was, you know, it was always very interesting and insightful to meet with him and have interviews with him. I mean, I think Paris actually is quite clear that he doesn't blame any one thing. I mean, I think he sort of says, yeah, I felt neglected by this, and yeah, I was annoyed by that. And he says that on the day he felt all day that he was angry that day and he wanted to hurt somebody. But he also says he was a coward and that you know, anything could have stopped him at any moment, and admits that what he did was cowardly. So he does take responsibility. I think, as I said, I'm not sure if he's had the opportunity yet to, or at least to articulate it to us yet, to really, you know, deeply understand the sort of psychological reasons why he did what he did. But he can, he certainly takes responsibility, that and appreciates that it was a horrific thing to do.
You feature in this documentary, too, the artwork of Paris Lee Bennett. Why is that, and what does that constitute? What are the, some of the examples that people will see? What is the subject matter of these, this artwork?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, as I said before, I think our limited access to Paris, but, you know, obviously his large part that he plays in this film, we thought, you know, when you interview someone in prison, it's a very rigid, contrived sort of situation. You don't get a lot of freedom to kind of see what someone's really like, because they're just sitting there behind glass and looking the same. And we knew there was more to Paris, and obviously his mother kept all this, all his art books and sketchbooks and letters, all this artwork over the years, and he'd always been a very good artist, and very interesting, intricate drawings. And so we thought that it would serve a nice purpose to, firstly, again, you know, kind of what I was saying before about using the archive to make the characters a bit more relatable.
Yeah.
We wanted to show that there was a time when he was a kid who drew, you know, octopuses and, you know, wild animals, and did cute, you know, family pictures and that kind of thing. And I guess we see as he gets older, his art becomes a bit more sinister. But it was a way of kind of getting a bit more insight into him, and
mm-hmm.
kind of showing how nuanced he is. And I think his art reveals immense talent, I think, as an artist. But also, there's a lot more going on. You know, there's a lot of thought behind everything. I think it was just a way that we could try and like weave in a bit more of him throughout the film, so it didn't kind of feel so black and white, because nothing about this story or this family is black and white.
And you,
so when
show
we had the
him
access
in,
to those, sorry.
Sorry.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so when we got the access, we thought we could try and select some of them to try and do little montages to kind of show a passing of time as well, and a kind of evolving, I suppose.
You talk about him being in, well, not talk about, you show him in the Ferguson unit in a correctional center not too far away from where Charity is. And she looks, and you have it in the film, that she looks up this notorious Ferguson unit and is concerned. What did you find out or know? You didn't go behind the walls or anything, but what do you know of this Ferguson unit and this place where he is? This man entered at 13 years of age, but you know of this place. What do you know of this correctional center?
The prison itself? Well, that was... So he was moved from a juvenile facility, which was, I think, further towards Galveston in Texas. And
right.
After the age of 18, he was moved from there to an adult prison. And it happened to be, that time that you see Charity looking up the prison. I mean, they didn't give any warning. They knew at some point they were going to move him to another facility, but they didn't tell you where or when or anything like that. So that was, you know, a real shock. I mean, I think all prisons are dark places, and places that, you know, awful things go on. And I don't know any more about Ferguson than any other facilities in the area. I mean, it's there's a large number of prisons in that area. It's about an hour or so from Houston. And I think all prisons are pretty dark places, and I think Ferguson Unit is no different.
You talk about filming and Charity is in the process of being pregnant and then finally giving birth to a son named Phoenix. And then you have a very powerful conversation with Paris in prison with Charity and with Phoenix sitting there as well. What is Paris planning to do and is doing in prison in terms of communicating with his stepbrother someday?
Well, I mean, I think as you see, I mean, it's something that Charity sort of struggles with. Of course, they, you know, they are related, and she, you know, supports them having contact. But I think at this point, you know, Phoenix is still so young, so I think it's still going to be limited for some time how much they communicate with each other. I think Paris does send him letters and little, you know, books or presents. I think one time they were reading The Hobbit. I think that was a birthday present that Paris had sent to Phoenix. So, I mean, I think I think time will tell. Obviously, that's going to be a very complicated conversation for Charity to have with Phoenix at some point. But I think at this stage, you know, he's still so young, and he may understand that there's a brother on the end of a phone somewhere, but I'm not sure how much at this point he really understands what that means. And I think that time will tell how that relationship unravels.
The footage in this documentary shows Charity talking again, not to Paris about her concerns, but when she does speak of him and when she does speak to him, it seems like, it really does seem like a very loving, concerned mother, and she's just dealing with the issues of her son in prison, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think that was one of the things that's, you know, the most admirable, or maybe the most kind of, you know, normal and to be expected in some ways about Charity. This is still her kid, and she wants to make sure he's all right and he's healthy and he's got everything he needs. And I think one of the things that this film maybe tries to do, or certainly something we talked about when we were making it, is the idea that, you know, well, certainly something we talked about when we were thinking about this in terms of juvenile justice, is we thought, you know, everyone should be seen as better than their worst act, you know, not to be defined by this one tragic moment. And I think in a family that's gone through this type of tragedy, I think you can get stuck, you know, and I think for people hearing it, they can kind of keep you stuck in this moment of tragedy and trauma, and that can be the defining thing that, or the moment that kind of defines everything else. And I think that what we learned through making this film is that it's not really like that. You know, you sort of at some point also, yes, that may have changed everything. That might have been the final moment that changed things. But there are many, many different ways that we relate to each other. And I don't think that Charity and Paris's relationship is only defined by what he did. I'm not saying that's not complicated, but I think there are many different ways, many different ways that a relationship is defined, and I think for them, you know, ultimately, them, mother and son.
Given that she is this unconditional love and she's supporting him, but for everyone else, again, it seems like it can't be anybody's more their business than Charity. But what would you think? I mean, again, you're not saying this in the film, but I'm asking you personally. What would you think society or the judicial system should have done with Paris, or should do with Paris? What is the alternative to what was done? What do you think should have been done?
I think Paris for someone who commits a crime like that, I mean, I think they need help. I don't know how, I don't know what putting someone in prison for 40 years is going to do. I don't know. I've really struggled to believe that it's going to make him any sort of more likely to be rehabilitated and redeemed, or make society any more safe. And I think, you know, prisons are really there to keep people safe and to rehabilitate people and to punish people. I mean, it is there for punishment as well, but there are these two other factors to keep people safe and to have some sort of process of rehabilitation for people who've committed crimes. And I think somewhere along the way, I feel anyway, that justice system's lost its way and it's become so much about punishment and not really about these other two elements. And you would think that after 40 years, it's a really huge chunk of someone's life to not be able to really have necessarily keep people more safe or to offer a real kind of chance at rehabilitation. I think there are some questions about that system.
Were you opposed to a prison sentence versus a mental institution, or were you more so, concerned and disturbed by the lengthy sentence itself given to a 13-year-old child?
I think both. I think that I'm not familiar enough with the sort of psychiatric facilities or the kind of other possible help that would have been available to know what would have been the right fit. But I think perhaps a more holistic conversation about what kind of help, and also, yes, the length of time. I mean, I think 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, does it, at what point does it really make any difference,
Mm-hmm.
You spend 10 years in prison, are you going to be any more likely to be redeemed or rehabilitated? I don't know. If you don't get the right help, if you don't kind of maybe have some other way of trying to operate in the world. And I think Paris really gives some valuable insight on that. I think it was, he does understand the sort of, the environment he's in. It's violent and aggressive and is a place of survival. It's a place that you just have to survive. And I think that's something that we forget about, or we don't always think about when we think about prison. We create this environment that is a very difficult environment to really try and focus on anything else. Is it just a place that encourages people to bring out their worst qualities rather than somewhere that can maybe nurture the other side of other parts of what people are?
Does charity fear that this violent prison environment will change her son or not? Regardless, does she have any qualms about his eventual release?
I mean, I'm sure she does. We talked about that quite a lot on and off. I think it's something she's afraid of and she's worried about it. And I think she hopes that by the time that comes, she will feel, she doesn't know what her relationship will be with Paris at that point, or what place he'll be in, or how he'll be, what kind of work he might have done by that point. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know whether it will be qualms or what it would be, but I'm sure there is anxiety and concern and ambiguity around that, around the idea of when he comes out, what that will mean.
But she's not giving up on him. It shows in the film or incident where she says, "I had enough," but certainly doesn't look like she's giving up on her son, Paris, anytime soon, does it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, she takes what she would call mental health breaks, which is, she will have time where she's just like, I just can't you know, we can't communicate for a while. You know, whether it would be because they had a row about something or a disagreement or something, or she will just decide, no, I need some time to, you know, for myself. And during the time of us filming, I think there was about a year when they weren't in touch. And so I think she, you know, she always seems pretty good at knowing what she's able to give. I don't think she's would be someone who would show up and visit him just to kind of give him a hard time. I think she'd always try to, if you're going to be in it, you know, try and get what you can from that relationship.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I don't think she would. I'm not saying she wouldn't walk away, but I don't, that's not something she's done yet.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to thank you very much for coming on, Katie Green, and talking about The Family I Had, an engrossing look at an unthinkable crime. For those people that, I know this release has just been in March, so just recently, where could they view this? How could they get a chance to take a look at this?
Yep, this, I believe we are available. Let me just double check. I think it's Amazon Prime Video, iTunes, Vudu, and Google Play, I believe.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and so it's available on demand, so people can go out there and purchase it, The Family I Had. I want to thank you very much, Katie, for coming on and talking about this very, very, very powerful documentary. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you
very much, and hope to talk
to you
again.
Thank you very much.
Sometimes. Thank you.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having us. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.